This is the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast from Taylist Media in association with KBB Birmingham 2020.
Welcome to the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast. I'm Andy Davis, the Managing Editor of Taylist Media, and I'm very pleased to say that joining me in the room today, we have the full contingent of editors who are...
Elspeth from Studio Magazine.
Lindsay from Kitchens, Bedrooms and Bathrooms Magazine.
And Rebecca from KBB Review.
This is fun that we're all here. It's like three women and one man, like the Boney M of Kitchens, Bedrooms and Bathrooms.
Fantastic. Can I just say we have got a plate of Jaffa Cakes as well. I mean, life doesn't get much better.
Of course, there is a huge contingent of the audience now thinking, who the hell are Boney M?
And
I think that's sort of... That's mainly Lindsay here.
Yeah, I'm thinking that. Yes, I am.
It's just you and me.
I'll be honest, I wouldn't be able to pick a song out. But that says more about my music tastes anyway.
I'll take that on you.
Welcome everybody to the Boney M podcast. But as always, we're going to start with a bit of a roundup of where everybody's been, I think, because it does kind of indicate the kind of lives that we have within kitchens and bathrooms, and also the kind of stuff that is going on in the industry. But unlike last time, we have a little sting. Are you ready?
Taxi!
That's basically my life.
That is brilliant. I like
so
that.
So this is opening of an envelope. So Elspeth, yeah. Where have you been?
The three of us, me, Bex and Lindsay, went up to the Rockerlaufen headquarters in Leicester, which was really interesting. I didn't realise how much Laufen in particular, how much bespoke product they made, which is great for interior designers. And this week I also went and had lunch with Mark Taylor Kitchens in his kitchen, which is very interesting because that's how he shows the products that he makes. We also went to Porcelanosa.
I've also had the pleasure of going to Rockerlaufen up in Leicester. The sheer scale of the operation up there is really fascinating, and how many products they sell, right from, you know, the more basic developer house ranges to Armani Rocker, which was very, very glamorous. And I, this week, went to Charles York. They've got a new showroom in Weybridge, which is really lovely, and they've set it up like a real kitchen. So rather than having lots of different styles of kitchens on display, say two or three sets, they've just done one set and just really put lots of effort into making that one work. So you really feel at home.
I think you'll see that more and more and more at the top end, I think, because you're really selling a lifestyle rather than a showroom full of product.
Yeah.
You'll see that more and more. Bex, now, let me guess. You've been to Rocker and you've been to Porcelanosa.
That is absolutely true. I have also been elsewhere, but from a sort of more business perspective, I suppose my experiences at Rocker and Laufen, obviously, the HQ for me, it's kind of twofold. It's a European brand investing in the UK market, which is great to see at any time, but particularly at the moment with the Brexit situation hanging over everybody's heads. But also, if anyone had ever been to their previous HQ, it's much more of a befitting HQ for a brand like Rocker and Laufen in the UK. So that's great. And they've obviously, these showrooms are a great tool for retailers because they can take clients along to see a wider range of products than they can probably have in their showrooms. Porcelanosa, yeah, that was also a great opportunity. Glad to say that they're actually doing the Porcelanosa HQ is in Watford, and it's good to know that they're actually doing a lot better than the local football team.
Another big European, well, another big Spanish European brand as well, investing in the UK. I mean, they're much bigger than people probably suspect within the retail market.
Yeah, I mean, bigger than I thought.
They've got 21 showrooms in the UK. So, and I mean, the HQ showroom in Watford is pretty impressive. So it's a really big operation. And I also got the opportunity to go to see PWS up at Newton Aycliffe to see a lot more of the investment that they've been doing over the last 2 years, including $5 million in a new paint facility, which actually gives them a lot more opportunity to provide a more efficient and better service for their retailers. So it's kind of a win-win for their retail network.
Well, there you go. British company investing in the British market.
Yeah,
as well.
A lot of investment going on, so yeah. That's great.
Well, as you know, I hardly ever go anywhere. And because of that, I'm going to actually revisit the conversation we had last time. Now, if you remember in the last episode we did, which is actually episode 2, everybody, we talked about whether or not we were in the golden age of kitchen and bathroom design. And the basic conclusion was that you all thought we were, and I thought we weren't. So Bex, you in particular, have been out to try and find out what actual designers actually think about whether we're in the golden age or not.
Yeah, that's right. I got the opportunity to chat to a few leading designers at the recent KBSA AGM and conference.
So here we go. Let's see what they've got to say.
Hi, my name's Craig Matson. I'm the MD of Roundhouse Design and also chairman of Kitchen Education Trust. I would say it was golden age, or I could say they're all golden ages. Things change constantly. So there's new materials and there's new mechanisms. We're responding to all of these things as they occur. And it's good design. There's not some amazing ability that we've all of a sudden discovered. But also, there's a little bit about education as well. You know, there's a little bit more, you know, the more educated the industry is and the individuals in the industry, the more creative they can be. So it's good to get a good level of education.
This is Rob Mascari, independent kitchen retailer based in Nottingham. I think we are potentially on a golden age of design, but I think it obviously needs a bit of thought as to how and where we develop and move things to get to exactly where we need to be. I think we could possibly, if we're not careful, end up in a bit of a stalemate of just carrying on doing the same old thing. So, you know, sort of moving forward, I think we need to explore opportunities for future generations that are going to be coming through and how we're going to evolve our business and what our product's offering accordingly so that we can cater for a new generation that are going to filter through and they are ultimately going to be our next clients. Possibly it might be driven by smaller manufacturers trying to look at new ways of doing things, and then hopefully maybe at some point, you know, that gets taken on board by the larger manufacturers.
My name is Keith Myers. I'm from the Myers Touch in Winchester. I'm not sure what you mean by golden age, so that's kind of an interesting point, but I think hopefully we never reach the peak of creativity. Hopefully there's always something new. I think creativity in its essence has to be something new. So I think once, even as humankind, if we get to a place where we have stopped somehow, then that's a really disappointing place to be, because there's nothing else beyond it. So I would always hope that there would be a huge opportunity for creativity. Doesn't mean to say that form of creativity might not change in the way it looks and the way it feels with other things like technology and all these sorts of things. But in essence, people don't really buy kitchens. They buy what happens in them. And therefore, that whole concept really changes the way sometimes, even as an industry, we should approach what happens. And sometimes I think we get too lost in products and that form of creativity versus the whole aspect of the creativity of life that you can have in that place. So hopefully life never ends, so therefore creativity never ends.
Life never ends, therefore creativity never ends. Now, I was going to draw an awful lot of conclusions there about how they all agree with me and didn't agree with you. Right,
disappointing.
But then I heard the philosophy of the design philosophy of Keith Myers. I don't know whether I can really top that. Life never ends, therefore creativity never ends. I think that should be the podcast motto. What do you think?
Very deep. Yeah. Perhaps a bit too deep for me.
Yes, I know. I think at this time of the day, I haven't got anything to add to that.
All right. Well, look, we're going to do I'm determined to make traditional survey of the week, and because we're going to make this traditional, there is also, of course, a jingle for this too.
Survey of the week.
Right, so this survey of the week this week is actually, it's a few weeks old actually, but it's the Global Kitchen Study by the Silestone Institute, which is obviously part of Cosentino. And this is the second year they've done this big survey that looks into how kitchens are used all across the world. And they don't just speak to designers, they speak to chefs, architects, nutritionists, sociologists, food historians, all kinds of people. So here are the questions. Are you ready? How many people in the UK take their own bags when they go food shopping and prioritise products with less packaging? Percentage, this is.
Oh, own bags, that must be really high now. I would say at least 80% of people.
Yeah,
but
agree.
I think people are still a little bit scared of unwrapped fruit and veg.
I think we'd like to think it's a lot higher. So I'm going to go for more like 60% on the own bags.
Well, it's somewhere between, it's actually 72%. But is that higher or lower than the global average?
Lower.
Higher.
You're going higher?
Yeah.
Higher than a three, you say? You're going for lower. It's actually higher. The global average is 52%.
Wow. Well,
okay. So that, yeah. Go the UK.
Go the UK.
So that 5p.
That's because we're really tight, though, isn't it? I think it says a lot more about that.
Okay, question two. Here we go. How many people in the UK use their kitchen for activities other than cooking and eating?
Oh,
high.
What does that imply? I don't know.
Well, like entertaining.
Oh, okay, yes.
And homework.
Oh, yeah, lots then. 90%.
Nothing dodgy.
Okay. Or perhaps dodgy as well, but we just won't go there. 90%.
87.
75.
Oh, it's 34.
No.
Sharp intake of breath.
But is that higher or lower than the global average?
lower.
It is higher. The global average is 17%.
What? People is going on?
People only cook in their kitchen.
Who have they surveyed?
They haven't defined activity. That's the trouble.
They only cook and eat in the kitchen. And finally here, okay, now this is quite vague, but what percentage of people prioritise functionality over design, quality and cost savings in planning a new kitchen?
Very few. I would say low.
Hmm. Yeah, I think only really professional people would think about that. I think most people go by
15%?
Looks. I'm going to go 27% optimistically.
Well, it's 63%.
Is this a good time to start looking for a new job?
Yeah, I think we failed at Survey of the Week this week. We'll have to have
a okay.
No, but isn't that odd, though? Yeah, I think it's because 37% of people obviously don't prioritise functionality. They would rather just have a nice looking kitchen.
I'm not surprised at that, really.
I suppose that's the very top, potentially the very top end, where they're going out a lot more and they're not actually using their kitchens potentially to cook in. Yeah. They just want them to look great.
More of a show kitchen.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, that does lead us on to our actual discussion topic for this podcast. So today we're going to talk about a really interesting trend that I think is starting to have a real impact on how we use kitchens and bathrooms to a lesser extent, and therefore how those kitchens and bathrooms are designed. And that is the idea that staying in is the new going out. Okay, so people are preferring to entertain at home, stay at home, cook for themselves, relax after busy days, rather than go out and socialise. And I think this is driven by lots of things. Austerity, I think, is a big part of it. I think things like Netflix, you know, the idea that you can just stay at home and binge things. You can get all kinds of apps like Just Eat that can deliver food to your door. And, of course, there's lots of programs about how you should eat healthier and cook for yourself and, of course, bake for yourself. How is staying in affecting what people actually look for when they want to buy a new kitchen and, of course, bathroom?
Well, first of all, I want to put my hands up and say I am all for the staying in is the new going out. Saturday night on the sofa with Strictly, way better than a Saturday night on the tiles.
Or dancing on ice in the new year.
Well, yes.
I want to go out more now.
So I think because of that, people are more likely to entertain at home now. So when they're designing their kitchens or open plan spaces, or even go on open plan because they want to entertain more and have space for the whole family and friends and show off to their family and friends, let's face it, the design is all around bringing people together into that space and, you know, having a kitchen island, so that's the gathering point, having multiple seating areas, bar stools, dining area, sofa area for lots of different activities, and then incorporating things like bar areas and wine chillers. We're seeing a lot of that in kitchen design right now.
Yeah, I think the technology and the advancement of products, I think, has got an awful lot to do with this as well. That things like wine coolers are now affordable and most people can have them if they have the space. The way that open plan has pretty much taken over kitchen design as a whole means that it just lends itself to having space and areas to do things. I do wonder, though, whether the reverse is true, because I think sometimes you have to go out and see other places. And actually, a lot of trends are driven by going to boutique hotels or restaurants or seeing how bars have done their bathroom or done their interior. So what do you think, Elspeth?
I think definitely staying in is the new going out. We've seen a growth in also sort of box meals like Gusto and Go Fresh. I've signed up for Gusto and it's great because it is, you know, you get your whole meal and you can cook something really nice in the middle of the week. One area, and I know I'm going to be a bit controversial when I say this, that I would like to see not so much in the kitchen, and that is the island unit, because I think I know, right? Goodness. Because I think a big kitchen table is far more sociable, and I think now, especially with multi-generational homes as well, everybody's sitting in the kitchen, you know, the kids doing their homework. I find it much easier to use a kitchen table than a worktop because I'm fairly short, and I think they're a very sociable area. I don't have an island, and when I did my kitchen, I was under quite a lot of pressure by the kitchen designer to put an island in, but I held out for a very big kitchen table.
Do you not think people want both? They want the island.
I think people do want both, but on the whole, you can't. And I think it tends to be the table that's compromised, and then you only have seating for four, and I think a great big table where you can sit eight people, and certainly when we have people around, that's where we end up spending the whole evening.
Yeah, I think actually you've hit on some really interesting points there, particularly the multi-generational aspect and how easy it actually is to sit on bar stools comfortably and enjoy actually, you know, perhaps eating at them. That's where the dining table
I've
is actually.
I've seen quite badly designed sort of eating areas that go round, you know, a counter, and then you've got people sitting in a row rather than sitting round and talking. And I think the more we are spending time in the kitchen and socialising in there, I would like to see the return of the big kitchen table.
But interestingly, because I've seen quite a few case studies recently where the island has evolved from that bar stool area to have a dining table attached to it with some banquette seating possibly, so that aids comfort for one but also makes more of the island.
It's the idea of the theatricality of the cooking though, isn't it, as well? That's a big part of what's driven that, the idea that if you are going to stay in and not go out, somebody is going to sort of very theatrically cook for you, you know, start flinging bits of food about.
I always think that's a bit of a myth, isn't it, because realistically it's going to be a mess.
Yeah, but again, it's a technology thing, isn't it? Because the way extraction has developed means that you don't necessarily have to have big, massive hoods all over the place these days, thank God, because I'm very tall, and therefore I always bang my head on a hood.
But you don't want bits of sushi flicking into a Prosecco, do you?
I think a big part of that aspect as well is it's not just the theatrics of it, it's actually the chef doesn't want to miss out on the sociable side of the evening. You know, if you've got all your friends and family around, but you're the one stuck in the kitchen, you miss out on all the good chat, and actually if you've got the island unit there, the idea is that people can sort of sit there and sort of lean against it and chat whilst you're doing the cooking, so you don't miss out on anything.
Yeah, it all depends how it's designed, doesn't it? I mean, mine's a U-shaped kitchen with the sort of table right in the middle of it, so people are there and relaxing, enjoying themselves while I'm whizzing around the background burning things.
Well, I think a big part of it as well is the integration of music. And, you know, the TVs are now very flat and so can sit on the wall. You can stream music very easily into every room. You don't have to have, you know, big speakers or a big TV in the corner. So these places do tend to come quite hubs of everything. And I always hate the phrase, the kitchen is the hub of the home. I think that's one of those horrible clichés that we write far too much. But yeah, I think in this sense, it is probably very true.
The open plan aspect now allows you to, you know, have two uses for the kitchen, so you can have it for family time, you know, the kids can get involved cooking, or they can be doing their homework whilst you're cooking, like mum and dad are cooking in the kitchen. People have such busy lives now that's the opportunity to actually spend some quality time as a family. But then once the kids have gone to bed, it can become much more of an entertaining space.
I don't know. I sometimes wonder whether this is one of those things that people like the idea of doing but don't actually do. I've never met any designers or people who buy kitchens that they say, oh, we love entertaining. But I don't entertain very often. I'm a right misanthrope. I mean, how often do people actually entertain to justify these things?
Well, if you read the pages of KBB, probably 90% of people we interview,
absolutely.
When we ask what was the inspiration behind your design, what did you want, what was the brief, they say, well, we wanted somewhere to entertain and a family space. Those are probably the top two reasons.
Yeah, because entertaining isn't necessarily a party, is it? It's having your family around for a big Sunday lunch. I mean, my children have grown up and left home, but when they come home, we basically live in there. You know, from breakfast in the morning, we're still sitting around the table at 3 o'clock in the afternoon because it's just endless sitting around talking.
And my mum and dad, it's really similar, actually, because my mum and dad's kitchen, they've got this really very small galley kitchen. So I have to save all of the conversation points that mum wants to hear till after she's finished cooking. So it has to be, because there's nowhere to sort of really socialise in there. So that's a perfect example of a place that could do with being a more sociable, open plan space.
You've mentioned sound, Andy. I think that's really important, the whole smart home thing. But also I'd say lighting is crucial in being able to have dual use in your kitchen. And I mean, obviously most kitchen designers will already do zones. So you've got your ambient lighting and your spot lighting. You'll never get that homely, relaxed evening feel if you can't create soft lighting.
What we can conclude from all this then is that we need good lighting, and I haven't got any friends.
That's not news, Andy.
In a bit of a left turn here, we're going to take a little look at product safety in the bathroom, and in particular, how sure you as a designer can be that the products you are specifying are compliant in all the necessary legal standards for both safety and performance. This isn't about design, but it is about the business of being a designer. and how your own reputation is reliant on the quality of the products that you specify. Now, this is actually a much bigger issue than you probably think. So at the recent Bathroom Manufacturers Association conference, I sat down with the CEO, Tom Reynolds, to find out why they are making it such a priority. Compliance is a huge issue for the BMA, it's a huge issue for this industry, but what do we mean by the word compliance? What is the context of it?
The definition of compliance was one of the things which I drew out in my presentation at the BMA conference today. Did that thing of getting out the Oxford English Dictionary and looking what the definitions are. So first one, excessive acquiescence. So is that what we mean? Are we just the mugs that are kind of completing all of the red tape while others are getting away with it? The second meaning is around complying with rules and regulations, which is clearly what we do mean by compliance. But you know, that's not going to set the world alight. That's not going to gain the interest of specifiers and consumers, because 74% of the UK market, of British consumers, don't even know that there are rules and regulations governing bathroom fittings. So that's not going to be meaningful. We should start talking about the compliance agenda in a more narrative way.
So it's about, I guess, product safety, isn't it? I suppose is what the underlying message of it all is. It's about making sure that if you are designing a bathroom or specifying product, that those products meet certain standards that have been set and whether or not they are compliant with those standards. Which is all very laudable, of course it is, but is this a massive problem? What's the scale of this thing, do you think?
Safety, of course, is a big part of this. You know, we've heard horror stories about the toilets collapsing beneath people, sat on them and causing them serious injury. We've heard about shower enclosures shattering instead of crazing, causing serious injuries to consumers. And any injury to a consumer, of course, is one too many. But compliance isn't just about product safety. It's also about whether a product is going to do what it says it will. Mm-hmm. So it's about durability. It's about the fact that you know these products have been tested. So when it says that a faucet or a shower will do a certain number of cycles, you can be sure that it will do that number of cycles. For products that don't comply, it could be any old junk. The numbers kind of plucked from thin air. So as much as this is about safety, it's also about value for money.
And I guess and if you're the designer of that project, your reputation is very much tied up in the quality of the end product, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, through the whole supply chain as well. If you're an installer, you know, your credibility is tied to the products that you're installing. And if you're installing products which are going to fail much, much sooner than they should be, then you know you as a tradesperson are going to suffer the reputational damage for that. Mm. And the same can be said for specifiers, for designers, you know, across the board.
This is a topic that's very sort of contemporaneous, isn't it, because of Grenfell. Obviously, bathroom fittings had nothing to do with Grenfell, but it's put construction products and the viability of construction products right at the top of the agenda again, haven't they? And it's obviously become the number one item on the agenda for the BMA as well.
Yeah, there's something in the zeitgeist around compliance, and you know the Judith Hackett review into building products has obviously put this quite high on the trade press's agenda for something to ask the industry questions about, and rightly so. Underlying, there's been a frustration among manufacturers for many years that, you know, while if they're a good manufacturer, they commit to quite expensive testing, internal and external, product iteration to get it right, there are competitors that are more unscrupulous that aren't spending a penny. And, you know, that all goes into margin ultimately. So actually, financially, you know, yes, legally it's the right thing to do to be compliant. Morally it's the right thing to do to be compliant. But at the moment, financially, there are no consequences in the marketplace if you're not compliant.
And what I found really interesting about it, this isn't on the fringes, is it? This isn't some kind of black market style thing. There are big names here, which I'm not going to name because I don't want to be in court. But there are very well-known names that are selling non-compliant product in the UK. This is a real issue that even if you are a experienced designer or specifier, you just don't know.
People throughout the industry, specifiers, designers, are looking for some assurance now, aren't they? That's something which BMA, you know, through our strategy, are hoping to deliver. So we're currently going through a code of ethics audit at the moment with each and every one of our members, and only supplying compliant products is a key part of that code of ethics. So, you know, once that code of ethics audit has been completed, you can look at our membership list and with reasonable assurance can say, well, I know that they're a verifiable business that is only supplying compliant products.
Where does the liability lie with this stuff? Because if it's being supplied by a manufacturer or it's being sold by a distributor and something, God forbid, it goes horribly wrong, who's liable?
There's liabilities throughout, but primarily on the installer. And something that we want to do is talk to insurers to say, if you're providing professional indemnity insurance to the installer base, then you need to be sure that only compliant products are being supplied into projects.
But if you're the retailer or the designer through that retail showroom who's specified those products, is there a liability there as well?
It would depend on the regulation and the standard that we're talking about. So, yeah, there's consumer protection law, which has certain obligations on different actors throughout the supply chain. For things like the water regulations, then the illegality comes at the point of installation.
It's a really complicated thing. You know, the standards that are set and who sets them and who tests them. And there's a
horribly
dozen,
compliant.
There's a dozen different acronyms of organisations that set these standards. It's not an easy thing to sort of delve into and try and work out for yourself. It's really difficult to know where to even go to find out if products are compliant or they are not. Now, that is something that you're working on as well, isn't it?
Yeah, spot on. There's various different phases to this. So at the conference, we launched a compliance tool, which is an online website. It's not, I think it's fair to say, it's not in its final form yet. It's going to involve some further work to be suitable for all of the different audiences that it should serve. So consumers, specifiers, installers, indeed manufacturers. And the purpose of that tool is to demystify this whole very difficult to navigate environment of standards. So as simple as put in what your role is, you put in the products that you're interested in, and the output from that compliance tool are all the things that you should be looking for. Now, in the longer run, I think we need to provide something which is far more friendly to the consumer and visible and easy to understand, because I don't think that any of the current kind of means to demonstrating compliance are really cutting it with consumers at the moment.
It is, on the surface, a very dry subject, isn't it? It's not the sexiest thing in the world. But it is very important, particularly if, for the consumer, they're investing a huge amount of money in something that they want to make sure isn't going to either A, injure them, or B, just break and fail after a short period of time. If people know that there's non-compliant product being sold, and they know there's non-compliant product in the market, why doesn't somebody do something about it?
There is a big assumption at the moment that, certainly amongst consumers, that if it's on the market, that must be okay. You know, we live in the UK, we respect the rule of law in this country, and, products that are on the marketplace, it's counterintuitive that they're illegal. But that's the reality of the situation. One of the difficulties that all trade bodies are suffering from at the moment is that there's so much noise around policymakers and regulators at the moment that actually getting them to pay attention to really important issues like this is incredibly difficult, because they're distracted by Brexit or by trade wars or, tomorrow's kind of dog whistle politics, rather than, perhaps some of the drier but, really important issues like this.
Because nobody's kicking any doors down here, are they? It's a trading standards issue. I guess it falls on them.
Well, I can promise you we will be kicking doors down. We're up for this as a trade association. We're putting together a plan to try and kind of bang on the door of policymakers to make headway on this issue. So, we're going to be shouting loud.
So is part of that shouting loud naming and shaming people?
Oh, now, you know, you used the term earlier on in our conversation about staying out of court, and, you know, I've got no interest in dragging the trade association to litigation and things like that. But, yeah, I think we should call out when we're confident that non-compliance is taking place, we should call it out. Certainly, we are doing a code of ethics audit of our own members, and, you know, we don't envisage any problems. If you're a BMA member, you tend to be very serious about your legal and moral obligations on issues like compliance. Should we find through our audit that there are members that perhaps aren't fulfilling their duties, then we'll work to them to improve. And if there is a refusal to come into conformity, make no bones about it, we'll have to revert to a disciplinary process. So, you know, we're serious about this. And certainly among non-members, I've got no bones about naming and shaming where I'm confident that there's a non-compliant product.
So as a rule of thumb, you know, you've got that website coming out, which is a really complicated thing to put together, obviously. But as a rule of thumb, that CE mark is still a very applicable thing in lots of cases, isn't it?
CE marking applies to many bathroom products. It's not just the mark, it's what underpins the mark. So for self-declaration that your product conforms, you should still do testing. You should still provide documentation called a declaration of performance. And that's got to back up any CE mark on the packaging or product of any bathroom products that you're buying. What it looks like after Brexit, we can't be quite sure at the moment. Obviously, CE marking comes out of European legislation, and applicability to bathroom products comes through the Construction Products Regulation. Our best guess is that that will be adopted in some shape or form into UK law. There's talk of something called a UKCA mark if we leave without a deal. But some form of product marking will continue. Do consumers all understand those things that underpin a CE mark? I'm not sure.
Not necessarily, but I suppose if you're a specifier, a designer, you should have a certain level of expertise to be able to at least look out for schemes that are currently in place.
Professionals, without a doubt, I agree with you, Andy. They should know. And if I don't think ignorance is really a good enough excuse. Certainly, BMA's looking to work with partners in other trade bodies and institutes to put on training so that actually there's no excuses not to understand. And, you know, if you want to know more about this, there'll be learning opportunities. And, of course, we're constantly working with our colleagues in the trade press like yourselves to get the message out.
Well, that's brilliant, Tom. Thank you very much.
Okay.
That's it for this episode. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you don't miss any future ones. And it would be great if you could also leave us a very nice review. It really helps other people find us. See you next time.
The Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at KBB Birmingham 2020, the biggest kitchen and bathroom exhibition in the UK. It's on from March the 1st to March the 4th, 2020, and we'll be there recording live episodes for this very podcast every afternoon. You can register for your place at kbb.co.uk. See you there.